You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, July 24th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Ooh, it's good to be back. How's everyone doing?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Good, yeah.
We've all been on the road so many places.
On the go.
Apparently, both Jay and I got sick for the trouble.
I was a little sick, too.
I wasn't.
It's hard to shake hands with 1,000 people and not pick something up, you know?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, come on, skeptics, wash your hands, please.
I was talking to someone at work, and we were both thinking that maybe it's just airline travel. You know, you just... How can you get... You can't get away from germs in the plane, you know?
I think it's all of that. Like, cons, you've got people from all over, some with not the most sanitary habits. Admittedly, you know. Not everybody washes their hands. And you're all crowded into one spot. And yeah, it's the same with the airplane, with the recycled air. And then also, I mean, with me at least, cons mean staying up all night, you know, usually having too much to drink or, you know, something like that. And just overdoing it, like stressing yourself out to the limit.
Someone buys you a drink, they put their hand on the drink, you don't know where it's been, all that good stuff.
Ew, what?
Yeah. Right. I mean, you touch the edge of the glass, it's all over.
Oh, they lick the rim of the glass.
Yeah, I was picturing somebody just sticking their hand inside your beer or something. Hey, happy anniversary to the Curies.
Oh, cool.
You Pierre or Marie, Bob?
Oh, Marie, of course.
Yeah.
She was cooler.
Yeah. In 1895, Pierre Curie and Marie Sklodowska got hitched in France. Yeah. A team was formed. They, of course, went on to win a Nobel Prize. 2 years after they got married, they had a daughter, Irene, who married Frederick Joliot. I think that's how you say it. I don't know. And then they together won a Nobel Prize too.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
What was their prize?
Can you believe it? Also in chemistry, wasn't it?
Yeah, but her real first name was what?
Maria.
Oh.
Or Maria.
Maria. Yeah, Maria.
Maria. Mm.
Really?
Yeah, not Marie.
Like the moon?
She Frenchified it.
No, no E. It's a Y in there.
Like Mary A.
If you want to view her original documents and notes and stuff, it's protected in a lead box and you have to get all, you know, into a suit and put on protective clothes if you want to examine the original documents. They're so contaminated with radiation.
Oh my God. Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Well, cool, but you know, interesting.
Slightly tragic.
Yeah. It's unfortunate.
It's like almost inevitable that whoever really like discovered radioactive elements, started working on radioactivity would have died from it.
Yeah. You know,
before we learned how dangerous that it was, someone had to take that hit for the team.
Ouch. But hey, at least they died together.
They did.
Actually, I don't know how closely
Now that you say that, I have to believe that's what happened.
they got married, they won the Nobel Prize together, and then they died from
radiation poisoning.
A love story for the ages.
It started like Romeo and Juliet, but ended in tragedy.
Yep. Marie Curie is also famous for being the only female scientist that most people can name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is sad because she had a daughter who also won a Nobel Prize. So at the very least, you should be able to mention Irene.
All right. Well, we have some interesting news items to go through today. So I guess it was inevitable.
Yes.
That I would get sued.
Well, not just you, Steve.
Yeah, not just me. So the Society for Science-Based Medicine, SGU Productions, me individually, and just for good measure, Yale University, were all sued by Dr. Edward Tobinick for an article I wrote on science-based medicine over a year ago, in which I was somewhat critical of Dr. Tobinick's practice.
Ooh.
How dare you?
So the quick skinny on this guy is that he is he's a dermatologist and internist, but he decided to specialize in neurology without ever getting any formal training or being board certified. So he set up the Institute for Neurological Recovery, not to be suggestive at all, and he's using an off-label drug, Enbrel, etanercept, to treat a variety of things, including Alzheimer's disease, strokes, traumatic brain injury, and back pain due to disc disease. You know, how could one drug treat so many different things, you might be asking?
It can't.
Well, it probably can't. Yeah, so there's no, you know, double-blind placebo-controlled trials looking at Enbrel for, you know, Alzheimer's disease or stroke or traumatic brain injury. You know, he's claiming that these diseases are all caused by inflammation. And he has videos online showing people, like, within minutes recovering from their stroke, you know, after getting the perispinal, you know, injection of Enbrel, which is highly implausible.
Steve, isn't that a red flag of these pseudoscientists who, like, have one, there's one cause of the disease, right, for everything? That's a sure red flag.
Flags all over the place, which is what my original article was about. Just look at all the red flags. You know, one drug for many things, you know, such rapid recovery. Guy's not even a specialist with proper training, and he thinks he's, like, revolutionized paradigm shift in the treatment of all these various things. You know, he's really hard selling his services with these videos. He's targeting a fairly desperate population with unmet needs. All the red flags are there. I'm also not the first person he's sued over this. Topodic was also the target of a medical board of California accusation against him. The board essentially concluded that he promoted and advertised off-label use of FDA-approved drug, claiming breakthroughs in innovation, that, you know, what he was doing was constituted unprofessional conduct under the California Business and Professional Code.
Did he sue them?
No. He actually had to agree to serve a 1 year on probation, during which time he was required to complete courses in ethics and prescribing practices. Basically a slap on the wrist. Yeah. Then he opened up a clinic in Florida, which I pointed out is a very friendly state to physicians who practice, let's say, non-traditional medicine. Clearly, what this represents is just his use of legal thuggery to try to silence criticism. That's what he's trying to do. I mean, I've written 1,000 of these articles, you know, dissecting dubious claims that go way beyond the evidence. You know, the guys, you know, if you read his reviews on Yelp, there are patients who claim that, you know, he invites them in for a free consultation. But the consultation isn't with a physician. It's basically with somebody who works for him. It's almost like just a sales rep. And then you have to pay to see the physician. And he charges something like $4,000 for a treatment.
Whoa.
Wow.
What triggered my blog post about him on science-based medicine was an article in the LA Times, which discusses his one particular case. There was a woman with Alzheimer's disease. And he gave her 165 injections over 4 years for a total cost of $132,000 at least. I mean, that's just calculating out what they said he was charging. And she continued to progress really without any apparent change in the course of the illness and died 4 years later in 2011. So, you know, that's pretty disgusting, you know, sucking $132,000 out of a desperate husband who's, you know, treating his wife for Alzheimer's disease. The lawsuit is underway, and, you know, it's a pain in the ass. What can I say? But we're gonna fight it. I mean, the thing is, we had this conversation. It wasn't much of a conversation, but we had to decide. You know, we could have taken the easy way out and just removed the post from science-based medicine. But, you know, I felt very strongly that if we did that, we basically would be baring our throats to every charlatan out there who we've ever criticized or are going to criticize in the future. Yeah, so we just couldn't do that. So even though we knew that this was going to be a risky and expensive endeavor, you know, I see we have no choice but to fight as hard as we can.
Well, geez, Steve, do you think that it's okay that we talk about this guy here on SGU now? Just kidding, this guy.
So, yeah, I mean, to be honest, so we announced that this week, this is where we went public with the fact that we're being sued. I wrote a blog post about it on Science Based Medicine and on Neurologica. ORAC wrote about it on Respectful Insolence. And, you know, the story is now spreading through the skeptical interwebs. And part of, you know, obviously the calculus of deciding that, you know, we need to fight this tooth and nail is knowing that the skeptical community has a history of supporting our own members who are targeted by lawsuits. You know, remember Simon Singh, who was sued, and mm-hmm. Paul Offit was sued, and Ben Goldacre was sued. So, you know.
We're in good company.
Yeah, when these things happen, we just have to, we have to fight as hard as we can.
But it, the lawsuit, though, Steve, it sets a very good precedent. We're letting people know that, you know, you can't sue someone out of freedom of speech and freedom of information. Yeah. You know, and most importantly, like Steve said before, you know, fighting this guy all the way to the very end puts a message out there that this is what we're going to do if you try to silence us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not spreading misinformation or misleading information or things that we know to not be true. We are actually stating what science says.
Yeah, it's my professional opinion about what the current state of the science is and this guy's practice. So that's perfectly legitimate public discussion and opinion.
Steve, he's suing you because he believes that that your post is some kind of advertisement.
Well, I wouldn't make any statements about what he believes. Let me just say that the legal strategy they're taking is to file under what's called the Lanham Act, which means that they're essentially claiming that my blog post was an advertisement for my neurology practice at Yale, and therefore constitutes unfair competition because I was unfairly criticizing this competitor from many states away who Yale didn't even know existed until this lawsuit happened.
Yeah. Oh, this is so slimy and so snaky and so, oh God.
You know, also in the science community, everybody takes heat, right? You know, the part of the scientific process is to publish in a peer review, which he's not doing, number one.
Publishing studies, just not publishing double-blind placebo-controlled trials. He's doing like what Stanislaw Brzezinski's doing. Oh, here's some case reports and case series and review articles and opinion pieces, but not the kind of data that would actually show if his treatments actually work or not. Because in my opinion, it's all placebo effects. It's like the cheerleader effect. And it's remarkably similar, by the way, to another Florida clinic that I criticized years ago, William Hammisfar, who was also treating patients years after they had a stroke with drugs, claiming that they could instantly, you know, reverse the symptoms of stroke. It's the same deal. You know what I mean? Remarkably similar population that's being targeted, claims that are being made, implausibility, huge amounts of cash on the barrel. In this case, you know, insurance does not appear to be covering these treatments. You know, why should they? Yeah, we'll keep you updated as the case proceeds. It's unfortunately going to be expensive, even if we get out by the shortest possible legal route. It's going to be tens of thousands of dollars. But we are getting lots of offers of support, so hopefully we'll try to, use what support we have to keep the cost as reasonable as possible. But that's how much, even a frivolous case, it's tens of thousands of dollars to defend yourself from a frivolous case.
What a waste of time and money too. You know, the amount of time that Steve and I have been directing towards this, just dealing with the paperwork and dealing with the what's next and talking to the lawyer and all that stuff. It's hours and hours and hours, and it's draining. You know, it's a big deal, and we haven't even gone to trial yet. So,
well, hopefully it never will. I mean, the goal is for it to get dismissed at some point along the line. We don't want it to get to trial, but I mean, I think the guy doesn't have a case. The fact that he's going, the advertisement route, and there are lots of signs that this is a desperate case. I suspect he was hoping to intimidate me into pulling the article.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think that he's going to go to the distance, but I think he was hoping that I would just cave at some point, but that's not going to happen, Dr. Tobinick. We're going to fight this to the end.
Many people have emailed us asking where they can help support this effort. So you can go to theskepticsguide.org/legal-defense.
So another thing cropped up today that I have to mention. You guys know our friend, Mike Adams, the health ranger from Natural News. This guy is a dangerous douchebag, and I mean that sincerely. So his latest rant is this long paranoid screed, basically accusing anyone who is not anti-GMO of being a Nazi sympathizer. And I'm not exaggerating.
Nazi card.
Plays the Nazi card. It's a Godwin from beginning to end, full of Nazi references, saying that people who are defending GMO are like the collaborators with the Nazis, and the Nazis killing people and using signs to defend
the Vichy's
their killing machine.
Much?
Oh, it's just incredible. The hyperbole. Yeah, it's incredible. He doesn't have a lick of evidence. He doesn't, there's not a link.
Never has.
To anything. It's just him pulling crap out of his ass, you know, just making stuff up and, you know, just literally claiming that anyone who defends GMOs is a paid Monsanto shill. He says it matter-of-factly that Monsanto hired these people to lie for them, and they basically are taking money from Monsanto and lying in order to poison and kill millions of people.
Here, I'll play devil's advocate. How about this?
Okay.
All right. Mike Adams has a serious mental condition that he cannot help himself from acting this way. What do you think about that?
I don't want to speculate about people's mental conditions because
I do.
Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah.
I mean, no, really. I mean, there's a sense of not of, of total detachment from reality from this guy to the point where
that is certainly one possible explanation.
Look, and this is about as nice as you can be about this guy, I think, and give him this sort of benefit of the doubt.
Well, and the things he's saying sound like things that will be, that could be grabbed a hold of by people with like severe delusions, like paranoid schizophrenia, and they could act on those delusions, which makes it quite scary, actually.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah,
he says, this is the money quote, in bold, he bolds this, talking again about Nazi sympathizers. It is the moral right and even the obligation of human beings everywhere to actively plan and carry out the killing of those engaged in heinous crimes against humanity.
Okay, yeah. So that spells it out.
He's trying to incite any loser who believes what he says into hunting down and killing GM people who are not anti-GMO.
Well, he updated his blog, Steve, to be very clear. And he said, those are the paraphrased words of the German government, not my statement.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the original way that he published it, number one. And number two, like, you can't quote someone. The quote completely agrees with his sentiment. Everything about this blog agrees with this sentiment. But then say, you know, but I'm not actually saying that because
I'm just quoting. Yeah, wink, wink, nod, nod. It's bullshit. Like,
give me a break.
I know. And then he goes on from there to basically say, we have to, basically inciting a witch hunt. We have to hunt down these people. We have to expose them. We have to put their names and photos and addresses on the website so everybody knows who they are. That's, I mean, come on. And then he quotes, and by the way, you have a moral obligation to kill them. Those aren't my words, though. I'm just quoting the German government. And then, but at the beginning of the article, he links to somebody who's done just that. MonsantoCollaborators.org is a website that apparently somebody else has made that has a nice big swastika on it and the words Monsanto. And then on the right side, it's all about how Monsanto has caused 270,000 suicides in India, which is a myth. It's total BS. Yeah. It's not true. And on the left are journalists, publishers, and scientists who are Monsanto collaborators. And guess who's on the list?
David Gorski.
Will Martindale.
David Gorski's on the list. He made the list.
John Stossel's on the list.
John Stossel on the list.
Wait, it says under David Gorski's name, key perpetrator of the poisoning of hundreds of millions of children with GMOs and vaccines. God, do they not even know who they, like, do they ever talk to Dave? Did they ever meet Dave? Yeah, he has killed hundreds of millions of children.
But, Jay, I'm sure you didn't miss the fact that I'm on the list as well.
Yay!
No way!
And under me it
Lucky
says,
you.
I know. It is a badge of honor, but I'm a little disturbed by the fact that he's actually telling people to kill me.
Yeah.
Another corporate science shill who attacks the Seralini study.
So, Steve, okay. You're a shill and...
I'm a shill who gets paid nothing.
And you're Randy's what? What did he say?
Crony. I'm Randy's
you're a crony.
Crony.
So you're a shill and a crony.
Yeah.
You're a shrony.
And therefore you deserve to
Steve,
be
maybe,
wiped out.
Maybe that's one day you'll be as badass as David Gorski and it'll say under your name, killed hundreds of millions of children.
Hundreds
like
of millions.
Like he's not even
children.
A pediatrician.
Yeah, but Steve, hearten up. I mean, I don't think he actually ate children, so you got that going for you.
That's true. I'm also a child eater. Don't forget.
You're a cannibal.
Under publishers, they list Discover Magazine, National Geographic Magazine, Modern Farmer, MIT Technology Review, Forbes.com, Yep, they're all shills for Monsanto.
Now, yeah, to put this into perspective, first of all, Steve has already had a stalker show up at his house.
That's
and,
true.
And it was scary. And
when was that?
About a year ago.
The guy had an article from Skeptical Inquirer that Steve wrote, right? You wrote the article, Steve?
Yeah, yeah.
And finds Steve's address, shows up at his house, and the guy had to be removed. Like, seriously. Yeah. All right, so now, you know, who knows who's reading this guy's blog, and who knows how close they live to Steve or any of these people?
Yeah, that's messed up.
Yeah.
And that's a true call to action. Like, this isn't, you know, he is not being subtle here. So, you know, I joking about it actually relieves some of the, you know, the craziness. You know, it makes you kind of feel better about it. But the real deal here is that this guy, I think there is something, you know, I think he committed a crime by writing that blog.
But yeah, Mike Adams, I mean, he's always been a lunatic. Now he's a dangerous lunatic.
Yeah.
You know, he really should be ashamed of himself. This is just a shill for his supplements, you know?
That's the ironic part of the whole thing, too. Who's doing the real damage here?
Yeah. Oh, just the whole thing reads like bizarre world, you know? And it does show, yeah. I mean, if he's sincere, if this is just not all a game that he's playing, you know, this is how they see the world. They're the army of light and skeptics. We are Hitler. And it was an age of autism. I don't know if you guys ever peruse their blog.
Occasionally when I hate myself.
Yeah. So they recently put up a post basically portraying themselves as like Aragorn and the Army of Light, and we're Mordor. We're the host of Mordor.
We are?
Oh my God.
This is how these people view the world.
Yeah.
I wonder who the Ents are.
I think we all know who the Ents are.
I'll tell you one thing that none of these people ever say. I'm wrong frequently, and I change my mind. You know, just give me proof, and I'll change my mind. Right? Like, none of these other people are saying this. So while we're on this topic, real quick, I just want to throw this in. Did you guys see the post about Ben Stein?
Yes. His sexting.
Yeah.
What was that about?
How embarrassing and creepy. Oh boy. Like, this is really, like, the freaks are coming out this week, guys. I don't know what's going on, but it's truly happening. Like,
I could just see his text. Can you take off your panties?
Panties.
The quick thing is that he was going to give this woman who was having a baby out of wedlock or a single mom, like, he was going to give her some money to help her and everything. But it all was basically like, I'm going to give you this money to help you, and you're going to send me naked pictures of you. And then when we meet, you know, I want to hug and kiss you. That's what he said.
He wrote an article because he's very much pro-life in addition to being, you know, anti-evolution and anti-science in general. He's anti-abortion. And so he wrote this article about how wonderful and giving he is, and said that, you know, there's this woman who was going to get an abortion. And so he gave her a load of money so that she could keep her child. And then she released the text where he basically yells at her for not agreeing to be cuddled.
Gotcha. A little backfire. Yeah.
Maybe spell check got the better of that text or something. I don't know.
Nothing, though, will ever beat Prince Charles getting caught.
Yes.
The whole tampon comet, nothing will beat that.
No, ew, I don't even remember that, and I don't think I want to.
Bloody hell.
No.
Anyway, let's move on to some other news items. This is crazy night tonight. We got some crazy stuff going down. Evan.
My stuff's not crazy. Mm.
I understand another Malaysia airline went down. We do have to get a little serious and say that we, obviously, our hearts go out to the families of people who were lost in the Malaysia flight MH17 downing, but already this has spawned some conspiracy theories.
It certainly has. Now, Malaysia Airline Flight 17, or MH17, went down on July 17th, 2014. It was a passenger flight, a Boeing 777, heading from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. And it's believed to have been shot down with a surface-to-air missile, although they're still investigating exactly who is responsible for this. It is believed the main theory right now is that it was shot down by pro-Russian separatists inside the Ukraine. And we'll get to that in a minute. But in the meantime, when your worldview is one of a skeptical nature and you hear of this kind of terrible news breaking, you first feel shock. That's followed pretty quickly by horror. And about 10 seconds into wrapping your mind around this situation, you start to think, oh, geez, what are the conspiracy theorists actually going to make of all this? And there's actually I'm not really exaggerating. I do believe that in a matter of seconds, if not minutes, you know, these conspiracy theories started to go out there. It was Charles Haddon Spurgeon who originally said that a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes.
Well, no one really knows if he was the first to say it, which I like about that particular quote.
It's nobody really knows to both Mark Twain and Winston Churchill, but
that's the famous person effect. Yeah, quotes get attributed exactly. to famous people, even when they didn't say them.
So I knew that when I saw them, like, I got to go a level deeper here. So Charles Spurgeon, I'll put my nickel down on him, British preacher. In any case, so. Look, we know the gathering of evidence and analysis of the evidence, it takes time to sort out, but these conspiracies and falsehoods, they take seconds, if not minutes, to generate on the internet. And before you know it, there are hundreds, thousands, if not millions of people all over the world reading all sorts of ridiculous claims. So while they were still figuring out what was going on, the wreckage was smoldering and the bodies, you know, were still warm, the first batch of conspiracy tweets went out. Here's one. Hashtag Obama trying to kill, hashtag Putin. Putin's plane was following almost the same route as crashed Malaysian Airlines MH17. So essentially what was happening there is that they're claiming that they mistook it as the plane that Vladimir Putin, the President Putin of Russia, was in the plane, and that was the real target. And, you know, so there's that. But actually, his plane did not follow that route. That was quickly put to bed. Next one that came out, Rothschilds tried to kill Putin and they hit the wrong plane today because of BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, banks, and the USD, E-N-D. How stupid could this Zionist idiot be? Okay, so apparently Israel and pro-Israeli people are part of this now. Here's the next one. Escalating war intentions. Date 717, flight 17, plane 777, conspiracy theory. So there's some sort of numerology going on there.
Always.
Although I think what they're referring to is that this particular plane first flew, they say, on July 17th, 1997. And it went down on July 17th, 2014, and there's some undeniable significance to this, apparently.
And don't forget Flight 800. TWA 800 was brought down on July 17th.
Now, yeah, and you guys know certainly about that as you've done, you know, a little investigation into what happened there. Because for the longest time, I don't know, do people still believe that it was shot down by a missile?
Absolutely.
So that conspiracy theory still has legs to it. And this obviously... Here's some conspiracy theorists. They believe that this somehow ties into that as well. How could it not? So various reports also came out. There were a pile of perfect passports recovered with no damage. Two of, with faces on the passports that look like computer generated images. So there we go. We're already seeing that evidence is starting to be planted at the site, you know, trying to make it look like some sort of cover up.
Yeah. So that's ridiculous for a number of reasons. You could watch that on YouTube, you know, the video, like, of showing video of the people showing the passports. First of all, there's like 20 passports or 30 passports there out of the hundreds of people on the plane. I'm sure some people had their passports, you know, buried deep in their carry-on or whatever, and they survived. You know, it's not that, right? That's not that unusual that they were able to recover some undamaged passports. They mentioned these passports all look new. Why aren't they, you know, like old and worn? And okay, well, how many travelers get their passport for the trip that they're taking? I remember when we went to Australia a few years ago, we all had brand spanking new passports.
Yeah.
Maybe not Rebecca because she travels more than we do.
But I didn't either because I go to Sweden now and then.
Yeah. But like most of us did because my whole family, you know, Bob did, and we all had to get new passports because we hadn't traveled in a while. All right. They expire after 10 years. Anyway, so that wasn't remarkable either. And just saying they look like computer generated people, that's just subjective, you know,
nonsense.
Yeah. I mean, they look perfectly fine to me. I would never have thought that if the person didn't mention something. They look like normal pictures. It's just silly.
Here's another one, guys. MH17 is actually MH370, which is, of course, the Malaysian Airlines 777 that went down in, supposedly went down. In the Indian Ocean. So here, they're both the same plane, same airline. A commenter from Above Top Secret stated it could be the missing plane, rigged with explosives that had only just reappeared after vanishing for months. Why would they do this? Why? To start World War III.
Obviously.
Of course.
All right. How's that working out?
So, yeah, right, exactly. All right, guys. So what probably did have. Well, obviously they're still investigating it. Nothing's been determined officially, definitively yet. It's a war zone going on there. This is going to be, it's a mess to try to sort through it all and just try to prevent local authorities from tampering with evidence. And there are legitimate concerns, and this is going to be a long, drawn out process and very, very sad for the families involved here. But here's what here's what I think is a, you know, good candidate, a reasonable candidate for what happened. There is audio out there of pro-Russian rebels admitting to shooting down a plane earlier that day, something like 20 minutes later. There were radio broadcasts that were picked up and recorded. And here's some of the transcript of what those recordings. Now, these are between pro-Russian rebels in the Ukraine, going back and forth between them. One guy says, "We've just shot down a plane. It fell beyond this town." The other guy rings in and says, "Pilots, were there pilots?" And the guy answers, "Gone to search and photograph the plane. It's smoking. How many minutes ago?" "About 30 minutes ago." They're saying the plane fell apart in the air in the area of such and such place. Too difficult to pronounce. "What do you have there?" "It was 100% a passenger civilian aircraft." "Are there people?" "Holy shit, the debris fell right into the yards." "What kind of aircraft?" "Don't know yet." "Is there anything left of the they asked if there were any weapons or any evidence of weapons, and they said absolutely nothing. There's civilian items, medicinal stuff, toilet paper. Are there documents?" "Yes, there's an Indonesian student document. And the commander says, basically wraps up by saying, "They wanted to bring some spies to us. F*** them. They should not fly. We are at war here." So this is just parts of a larger conversation that go on. You can find it online. It's easy to find. Also, one of these Russian Ukrainians apparently went onto their Facebook page and made a post about it not long after it went down, stating that they had taken down what they believed to be, you know, an invader's or military aircraft. A military target was hit and brought down. And then like an hour later, that post disappeared when realized that, oh, it was a civilian aircraft going down. So I think the truth lies somewhere here. And I don't think there's anything, extraordinary. I don't think you have to jump through too many hoops or draw too many conclusions to see that this is probably one of the more likely paths that this will take as this unfolds.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's really fueling these conspiracy theories, though, is actually the Russian state press. Did you guys read Julia Ioff's piece in The New Republic? It's really eye-opening. It's a look at what the Russian media is reporting about Flight 17. And it's pretty much exclusively conspiracy theories. There's not a word about the pro-Russia Ukrainian rebels. There's no interacting with the victims' families, which is fueling these conspiracy theories that say, oh, well, you know, the victims didn't even have families. So, you know, these were made up people. If they had families, we would see them on the news. Well, the news isn't putting the families on the news. So a lot of this seems to be aided by this pro-Russian media that is helping to kind of cover up what's happening here. And it's pretty disturbing. To put it out there, my favorite conspiracy theory, of course, is the one that claims that the plane was actually full of corpses when it left Amsterdam, and that the pilots took off and then parachuted to safety after the plane was in the air. And then later on, bombs were detonated, blowing up the plane over Ukraine. And of course, if any of you watch Sherlock, you know that that is actually a plot from one of the episodes of Sherlock.
Yeah.
And right. Yeah, it's being reported as news, like as an actual theory for what happened on Russian mainstream media. So, I mean, thank goodness for the internet. I just hope that enough people in Russia have access to foreign news sources via the internet, because they're certainly not getting it from their local news.
All right. Well, we got one more crazy town news item for this week. Jay,
won't you take me to?
Yep. Jay, get us updated on Ken Ham's latest shenanigans.
Hey, Ken Ham. Yeah, I titled this one, Ken Ham is Talking Spam. So you may have heard.
Sounds like a Dr. Seuss book. Yeah.
Ken Ham I am.
I do not like Ken Ham.
So you guys heard about Ken Ham said that all aliens are going to hell, so NASA should stop looking for them, right? You've heard that?
Yeah.
But it's not.
Makes sense. I didn't believe it when I heard it, but yeah.
But it's not actually 100% factual. Ken Ham.
Oh, aliens aren't all going to hell?
Well, there's some wrinkles in here. Let me explain it to you. Ken Ham himself stated that the media is doing a bad job of reporting the truth. And he said that he did not, in fact, say that aliens are going to hell. He said that because they are not Adam's descendants, Adam from the Garden of Eden, Adam, because they are not Adam's descendants, then they cannot have salvation. Now, Ken Ham says that life did not evolve, but was specifically created by God. Now, the first question you might ask, this is what my brain went to when I heard that. If aliens exist, then God must have created them. And if God created them, then maybe God has other plans for them as well, right? Just plans we don't know about, because how would we know about God's plans anyway?
Yeah, and actually that brings up the point that if they're not descendants of Adam, and all sin comes from Adam and Eve, then it's possible that aliens exist and they are perfect.
No, but Ham's got you covered there, Rebecca. He said that they do have sin. They apparently, because Adam's sin spread throughout the multiverse.
What?
But his salvation is only for his descendants. But
well, that's not fair.
And it says multiverse right in the Bible.
Guys, Ken Ham specifically said, though, he doesn't even believe that they exist because of the word of the gospel. So he thinks because of all of that, therefore God would not have made aliens for whatever his reasoning is, but expressly they don't exist. So there really was a screw up here with the press stating all of those things, because I did read his two articles that he wrote on this, and he didn't really say that. It just implied.
I mean,
it's implied.
I mean, Neptune doesn't exist because it wasn't mentioned in the Bible. Planet Neptune.
No, so
yeah, unicorns that to so do many exist. Things.
So a few people that wrote about this, including Steve, put this Carl Sagan quote in there to kind of explain this other part. In one unremarkable galaxy among hundreds of billions, there is an unremarkable star among hundreds of billions of stars in that one galaxy. Around that star revolves a world with life. Some people who live on that world believe they are the center of the universe.
Yeah, that was a paraphrase, and Neil deGrasse Tyson paraphrased it in the New Cosmos as well. It's a very, I think, powerful sentiment when you put it that way. You know, it's like you zero in from the universe into this one little planet in the corner of one galaxy, and imagine the people on that planet thinking that they're the center of the entire universe. Not only that, not only the center of the universe, but Ken Ham thinks that the rest of the universe is just a show for us. And that when the salvation does eventually come, the rest of the universe is going to burn. Because it's just there for a show. You know, it's just like the parsley on your side of your dish. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just a garnish.
No, the Bible,
it's just a garnish.
The Bible says all... Yep, the Bible said it's all the world's a stage, and we are merely players. Isn't that the Bible?
And the other thing, Jay, that really struck me reading his post is how narcissistic he is.
Absolutely.
In that the universe does revolve around him. Not only that, but he writes as if scientists and skeptics, we define ourselves by not believing him. You know, it's like we are secularists. You know, scientists are secularists, and we're doing this to rebel against God. And we're looking for aliens so that we could prove evolution to finally stick it to those creationists. Yeah. You know what, Ham? We don't care about you and your creationism. We don't think about it all the time. We love science, and, you know, we love exploring the universe, and evolution is true because of all the evidence of evolution. It's not all about sticking it in your eye. You know what I mean? But that's... He writes as if that's like what it's all about. It's just all about his little belief
bonus.
System.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's sticking it in his eyes, just a bonus.
Just a bonus, yeah.
Yeah, and he says, like, to add to what Steve was just saying, Ken Ham wrote, many secularists want to discover alien life, hoping that aliens can answer the deepest questions of life. Where did we come from, and what is the purpose and meaning of life? Well, first of all, I'm not looking for aliens to answer the where did we come from question. And second of all, what is the purpose and meaning of life? I don't need to ask anybody else that. I'll define that for myself. Thanks, yeah. Ken. I'm certainly not going to get the meaning of my life out of a book.
Unless it's Dune.
Well,
Jay, if you could ask aliens a question, what would be your one question?
Oh my God. Really, like, putting me on the spot. Okay. So
how do I make a flux capacitor?
there's a lot of ins and outs, but I'll play your game, you rogue. You know, okay. So I'm asking a seemingly super advanced, super intelligent race a question. I guess my question is, how can I be more like you? You know, I'd want to know what, oh God, Steve, you know, what I really want to know, like, if I could ask any question just to get a really cool science answer.
That's the point. Yeah.
Is there a multiverse?
Yeah.
That, yeah. Is there a multiverse? That's a good one.
No, it's not.
You could ask string theory, loop quantum gravity, or some other third thing.
Yeah. Then they'll say Blargle Snazzle theory. Right. Or even worse, they just look at each other and laugh in their alien tongue. Who am I right now? Who am I right now? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
oh
I mean,
God.
What would you do if a cockroach asked you to explain the nature of the universe? It's like,
yeah, like a cockroach.
Where do I start?
Well,
a cockroach,
if it could ask.
Ask Steve, brown sugar
start
or
with
white
the bottom
sugar?
Of my shoe.
It's like, that's your question? Okay.
Well, Jay, wait till your son gets old enough to start asking incredibly naive questions.
And I'm ready. I love those types of questions.
Yeah,
I need to put.
I would be fascinated
context,
in what
though.
Kind of question a cockroach would have for me.
Yeah, me too.
And I would be happy to engage in a conversation with the.
I'm not saying that you'd feel too good to engage with a cockroach. I'm just saying there's some things a cockroach, even a talking cockroach, is just probably never going to grasp. I mean, it lives for a couple of days.
That's true.
Like,
yeah, but
you have a lot of time.
Serious point though is, if it could ask, then I would answer the question that it could ask, right? So question to an alien might seem naive to them, but given my question, give me a freaking answer. You know, that's obviously my question informs them what I'm capable of understanding in a way.
But also, you could also say, let me help you ask better questions.
Oh, so here's my question. What question should I ask you?
I guess I just feel
that's
like
a good one.
There's a very good chance that when we're talking about the ultimate nature of the universe, we might be talking about something like we've had this discussion before.
Yeah.
We might be running up against something that is simply unable to be grasped by the average human brain.
Yeah.
Like, it might be physically impossible for you to understand it.
You know, this all reminds me of a Babylon 5 episode where they found this probe. And they found this alien probe, and the probe basically asked a whole bunch of questions. Each question got a little bit harder than the one before. It's scientific questions primarily. And they deduced.
Like 2 plus 2, 2 plus 3.
They deduced that if you answer like all the way up to like question 20, if you can get to 20 and answer it properly, then
20 questions.
Then that's a clue to the aliens that you could be a potential threat, and then the probe blows you up. So they decided not to answer that one question, and they were cool.
Steve, could you remember, Steve, from your blog post about Ken Ham, you wrote something really cool that
I always write something really
cool. That Gould said about smashing the pillars of...
Yeah, that science is basically a process of smashing the pillars of our own ego. You know, that first we thought we were the center of the universe, then we realized that wasn't true. Okay, well, we're the center of our galaxy. No, that's not even true. Then that we're the pinnacle of evolution, and that's not true. You know, that we're unique in the universe, and that's not true. So
we're reduced down to just saying, my mother loves me.
Right, that we're completely unremarkable. Yeah, we're not special in that we are of the universe. The physical laws that made us exist throughout the universe. That doesn't mean though that, you know, that humanity isn't unique, that we don't have our specialness and that we can't, again, make our own meaning within our own context. You know what I mean? So yeah, we're a tiny little speck on a speck on a speck, but within.
You missed a few specks.
Yeah, but from our perspective, you know, we make our own meaning, as you said before, Jay. And yeah, but to the Ken Hams of the world, it's like, unless we're it, that the rest of the universe is sludge, is nothing, then somehow it doesn't have any meaning. It always strikes me as a very childish view of reality.
Yeah, 6-year-old. I read this in a Calvin and Hobbes once, and it was done very well. Only Calvin put it much more eloquently than Ken Ham did, but essentially... He said that the whole universe came down to him, and history is justified because Calvin was born. Basically, that was it. Very
Calvin
amusing.
Would have it all over him. Well, guys, before we go on to the next news item, I want to mention very quickly that Richard Saunders, our good friend from Down Under, has released a video called The Vaccination Chronicles. You can get to it at skeptics.com.au. Look up The Vaccination Chronicles. You'll get to it on the Googles. And it's a really cool project that Richard did. It's basically a lot of interviews with people who had vaccine-preventable diseases or new people who died from vaccine-preventable diseases. So it's a way of chronicling, you know, what the whole vaccination thing is all about, because it's important information to have. So give it a look. All right, Bob, tell us about Pits on the Moon.
This is pretty cool. I learned a lot about the moon, actually, doing research for this. So Pits on the Moon may prove to actually be a valuable resource for future astronauts if we ever get our butts back there again. Now, these pits are steep. They're big, steep-walled holes that exist in various locations on the moon, kind of like that pit that appeared in Siberia in the news recently.
Yeah, they look like sinkholes.
Yeah. Now, these were discovered using sophisticated algorithms that search through various high-resolution lunar images that we've accumulated over the years. And they found over 200 of them, varying in size from just 5 yards to more than 1,000 yards. So pretty big. And that's only after looking at about 40% of the lunar surface. So there could be, you know, easily 300, 400, 500 of these guys across the entire moon surface. Now, but they're found in generally two different types of locations. The first, as you might imagine, they found them in large craters where the impact was just so nasty that it created these pools of lava called impact melt ponds that later hardened. The second location is the lunar maria, which form familiar pareidolia images of the man on the moon that we're all familiar with, at least for our culture. Lots of other cultures have lots of different images that they can see. But these dark areas were once thought to be seas, hence the name Maria. But they turned out to be hardened lava flows that extend for hundreds of miles. Now, we're not exactly sure how the pits formed, but most common theories include the roof of caves or voids that collapsed. That one seems pretty obvious. Vibrations from meteor impacts could have opened some of these up, or perhaps underground lava flows. We have these on Earth that create these hollow tubes that eventually empty out. So you've got this tube of hardened lava that could have opened up. So what good are these pits? I mean, what are we going to do with them? Well, I think exploring them would be a hell of a lot of fun. But the main benefit would be as a likely moon habitat. And that's mainly because the moon is a lot deadlier than you may think. First of all, you can get hit by micrometeorites if you have extended stays on the surface. Chances increase that you can get hit by one of these. Sure, it's kind of rare, but if it did happen, you would probably be toast, because even a space suit would do very little.
No atmosphere to burn up those particles, right?
Yeah. Moon dust is actually another big problem that the pits could protect against. The deeper you go, the less of that the regolith. So and I know we've all heard of moon dust, but it actually really was a big pain in the ass for the astronauts. It's as fine as flour, but as rough as sandpaper. So it's kind of nasty just to feel it. And I didn't know this one. Some astronauts even had a physical reaction to this moon dust that they called lunar hay fever. And this was made worse by the astronauts when they would enter into the crew cabin from the outside. The air would eddy and swirl. You'd have these little mini dust storms that would just throw the dust everywhere and on everything. And also the spacesuits themselves had major problems with the dust. So it was just not fun and not something that you're going to want to live with all the time. But the worst thing about the moon's surface, though, is probably the radiation. Studies have shown that surface dwellers on the moon that are actually exposed to 30 or 40% greater risk from radiation than previously thought. You would think that the entire moon itself would protect you, right? You've got the moon under you. I mean, it's blocking half the sky or whatever. And so you would think it would at least block at least that half of the radiation so that you're not getting pelted from 360 degrees. But that's actually not correct. The surface under your feet is radioactive. When the cosmic rays hit the surface, they create these little nuclear reactions that spray secondary particles, neutrons, that can penetrate your skin and even mess with your DNA. Obviously, this isn't much of a concern if you're there for just a few days. None of this stuff is. But for extended stays, which I hope one day we will eventually have, all of this stuff can just get worse and worse and just be really nasty and even eventually deadly with the radiation, of course, especially. What the pits can offer, though, is great protection against this radiation. All they would have to do is construct a habitat in the pit. And if you build it away from the overhang by whatever 50 or 100 feet, then you're extremely well protected from this radiation. So we'll see what happens if we ever consider making these lunar habitats in these pits. I think it would be a great benefit. We'll really could actually help save lives.
You could build a monolith in one of these pits.
Yeah.
It's already there.
Yeah, wasn't it in 2001 the lunar base was underground? I guess it could have been built in one of these pits. It had that like kind of flower petal roof. Remember that? That closed back up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That was cool. All right. Thanks, Bob. So we'll be living in the pits on the moon one day.
Yes.
Well, everyone, we just have one ad this week. So we're going to take a quick break to tell you about the Great Courses.
Yeah, we love the Great Courses because it's a way that anybody can learn from top professors, the experts in their field. You can learn from them even in the comfort of your own home, much like when you're listening to SGU. Right now, we are watching the course on Understanding the Mysteries of Human Behavior by Professor Mark Leary from Duke University. Have you guys been watching this?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I think I understand myself better now.
Are you a mystery of the universe or a mystery of human behavior?
I am.
Guys, The Great Courses has been in production for over 20 years, and they've got over 500 courses on so many different subjects. They include science, mathematics, history, art, music, philosophy, so many more. They're available in video and audio formats, digital downloads, streaming, DVDs, compact discs. Watch, listen, your own pace, and no exams. That's probably the best part.
Yeah, the reason why we want you guys to try it is because we do know how awesome the Great Courses are. I'll remind you that Dr. Stephen Novella filmed episodes on the Great Courses, right, Steve?
Yeah, two of them.
If you order Understanding the Mysteries of Human Behavior, you'll get 80% off the original price. But that 80%, just like all the other offers that we're offering from the Great Courses, only lasts for a little while, so you got to move on it quickly.
So don't wait, guys. Go to thegreatcourses.com/skeptics. That's greatcourses.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Evan, we have to get caught up on Who's That Noisy?
Okay. Yep. Couple episodes to catch up on. So back from episode 469, we played this noisy. Here we go.
And for each of the needs that are not fulfilled, there's pain. And it's registered on different levels of the brain. And what we found a way to do is go back down into the brain and get those pains out of the system. So you don't have to take pills and stuff to stuff it back. What we do is get little by little, take the pains out of the system that are based on not fulfilled need.
That all sounds very cromulent.
Yeah, that's not babble at all, is it? Those are the words spoken by Arthur Janov. You may remember him from the 70s, cool dude, as an American psychologist, psychotherapist, creator of primal therapy, which he uses as a treatment for mental illness involving descending into sort of this repressed childhood pain experience, and you sort of scream out your bad stuff that happened to you when you were a kid.
Yeah,
no science behind it. It's, you know, Yoko Ono and John Lennon were perhaps his two most famous clients, and that's why, you know, all in the 70s he attained the fame and recognition that he may not have otherwise. So, Arthur Janov, there were plenty of correct answers, but only one winner this for that week. Heptron from the message boards, you're the winner. Congratulations. Now, moving on to episode 470. Wow, 470. Nice round number. We had this one. Here we go. Remember this?
Dear Jesus, now heal that eye. Heal that eye. Watch her head and the piano.
Kind of defeats the purpose of Jesus healing you if you're going to fall back in ecstasy and die of a head injury on a piano. So... very, very good advice from the one and only, Benny Hinn.
Yes, Benny
Hinn.
Yeah,
you know, guys know who Benny Hinn is.
Yes, we
do. Yeah, he chased ladies around while, saxophone played a funny song.
Gee, are you sure about, you sure about that?
Okay, so that we get it.
Wait, there's more. Benny Hinn's a faith healer and a real scoundrel. let's face it, when it comes to this stuff, and James Randi has gone after him, and many other, you know, prominent skeptics have had many, many words to say about his shenanigans and antics. Amanda Rivera, winner for episode 470 on Who's That Noisy. So congratulations. Very well done. Moving on, brand new Who's That Noisy. Tell me what's making this sound. So go ahead and send us your thoughts as to what made that noisy. You can email it to us at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, or go ahead and post it on our forums, sguforums.com. Look for the subthread called Who's That Noisy? It'll be in there. Good luck, everyone.
And if you have absolutely no idea, you can email us at WTF.org.
Yes. And WTF stands for Where's the Fork?
Right. All right, we're going to do one email this week. This email comes from John Turnbull from Sydney, Australia. Rebecca, this one is going to be covered by you. So do you want to read the email?
Sure. Love the show. Longtime listener and so forth. I look forward to meeting you all at the upcoming Australian Skeptics Conference. This question may be of particular interest to Jay, as he strikes me as a Weird Al fan. Sorry, Jay, I'm stealing this one from you. I was listening to the new Weird Al Yankovic album, Mandatory Fun, earlier today, and it got me thinking, always a good thing, do you think humor is a good introduction to skepticism? Weird Al's song, Word Crimes, is a good example of this. It attacks common grammatical and linguistic errors via a catchy, if somewhat disposable, song. George Robb also skirts the line between education and piss-taking in some of his songs, but humor can be a double-edged sword, particularly if people think you're making fun of them. What do you think? Is humor a good way to get around mental barriers that a logical argument may not? And then he offers us a hot air balloon ride when we come to Australia. Keep up the good work. Cheers, John Turnbull, Sydney, Australia. Thank you so much, John. And I apologize. You did address this to Jay, but I called dibs because I happened to give a lecture on this very topic, the use of humor, in science. I just gave it to the Minnesota Atheists, in Minneapolis last week.
Minnesota.
Oh, darn too.
Is that your Minnesota accent?
Yeah, Margie.
I'm sure it was real good, yeah.
I didn't meet a single person who talked like that. That's more Wisconsin. Sorry.
Really?
I learned it on Fargo.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, everything I learned about Minnesota, I learned in Fargo.
Yeah, well, Fargo is like different than Minneapolis.
Okay.
Oh, real good now. Okay.
So, John, you're absolutely correct in that, yes, humor is a good way to encourage critical thinking and science education. And yes, also, it can be a double-edged sword. You need to watch how you're using that humor, because sometimes you might have the opposite effect that you're going for. What I talk about in my lecture is three different ways that comedy can be of use. One thing is it helps get aggression out. You know, it makes us feel better. So when we're venting about skeptic stuff, like, you know, getting sued or someone threatening to kill us, and we use humor to do that, that's because humor actually does help people deal with sometimes upsetting or even traumatic things. And there have been a number of studies that back this up. One of the ones I talk about is a great one in which subjects were asked to make jokes about gruesome pictures, like a man gutting a fish. One subject made the joke, he always wanted to work with animals. And another made the joke, great job for people with body odor. So what the researchers found was that people who were able to come up with jokes about these gruesome images came away with more positive emotions and less intense negative emotions. But they found that the effect was most drastic with the positive jokes, like the first one I told you, he always wanted to work with animals. The effect was not quite as noticeable with sort of negative jokes, like great job for people with body odor. So that's one of the things that comedy can help you do, and that we do quite often in skepticism. Comedy can also, yes, help you learn. It can get around certain mental barriers that people have to learning. Another study I talk about in my lecture is Humor in Pedagogy by Randy Gardner. He forced 114 students to watch a series of 3 40-minute recorded lectures on statistics, which I think he chose because it was like the most boring topic he could think of. Sorry, statisticians, but it's true. And for some of the students, he cut in topical jokes, so jokes that had to do with the statistics lessons being learned. And for the other students, there were no jokes. And what he found was that the students who saw the funny lectures, and they did rate the lectures as actually being funny, the group that saw those lectures were more likely to report that they liked the professor, and they also were more likely to retain information from the lecture than the students who didn't get any humor. And the other thing I talk about humor being able to do is persuade, because there's been a lot of research that shows that there's this persuasion theory, basically, of humor that suggests that there are certain ways that humor can bypass our ability to think critically sometimes about what we're hearing. For instance, there's been a number, most of the research in this area comes from the advertising world, because they directly deal with persuasion and what is going to be the most persuasive for the greatest number of people. And by and large, they find that things like ironic humor can actually be more persuasive to people. And they think that it might be because it forces you to, it forces your brain to do more work to figure out what the joke is. And it makes you less able to necessarily deal with, to come up with arguments against what you're being told, basically. And the research that backs this up, there have been a number of studies where they look at the difference between just sort of goofy, easy visual humor and more like ironic wisecracks. And what they find is that people exposed to wisecracks tend to be more easily persuaded than people who are just looking at, you know, cutesy cartoons and such. So that's just part of the theory. There are a number of others. Humor tends to make people like the person better who is using the humor, which makes them more interested in, you know, being persuaded by them. If they don't like you, then it's not likely that they're going to be persuaded by any of your arguments.
So I watched the Weird Al Yankovic videos, especially the one on the tinfoil.
Yes. Oh my God.
They're funny. They're funny. But I think that kind of humor, like I can imagine a conspiracy theorist watching that. I don't think they're going to learn anything specifically. I mean, I think, you know, that was fluffy to the point where I don't think there's like any, I don't think people are going to walk away from that with any kind of hard hitting message.
Oh yeah. I should point out that when I say that his humor is the type that's good for learning, I don't mean that necessarily he's using it for that. but it is the sort of, yeah, it's like the sort of nice humor that could work if he does an educational type thing.
But I do think like South Park might be pretty close to the sweet spot. I mean, that they really do a great job on some issues, like using humor and satire and ridicule to, but, you know, with meat, you know, like that is, I think, a very great vehicle. Like, you know, we've often talked about the cold reading episode where they nail it. They totally show why cold reading works and why it's dumb. You know?
Yeah. And I think it's a really great point to bring up South Park. And I think that they're a great example, particularly of the use of, sarcasm and irony as a way to bypass, people making up, counter arguments to what they're saying. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, as people who want to educate and persuade others, it's very good when people on our side are using it. But obviously, we are talking about something that is, in a way, bypassing critical thinking. There have been some times that I've seen, like, a South Park episode, I'm like, oh, they're actually getting something really wrong here. And they're probably convincing a lot of people of something that maybe they shouldn't be convincing them of.
They're not right just because they're funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
But they are funny when they're right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're especially funny when they're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, guys, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-roni. Mm-hmm. We have a theme this week. I say that just to get the groan from Rebecca.
The theme is... I don't like giving you the satisfaction, but I can't help it.
I can't help the groan.
Primal reaction.
The theme is Those Amazing Animals. You guys remember that show?
What? Yeah. What Amazing Animals?
I remember Animals, Animals, Animals.
What?
And the new Zoo Review, but I don't remember.
I know Zoobly Zoo. Is that
what?
The same? Zoobly Zoo? No?
You're making that up.
227? Zoobly Zoo? Oh, look it up. I bet there are clips online. It was ridiculous.
It was terrifying. Those Amazing Animals was like one of the first reality TV shows. And it starred Burgess Meredith, Priscilla Presley, and Jim Stafford. You guys don't remember that?
Oh, my God.
Burgess Meredith. Yeah. You can't win, Rock.
Burgess Meredith.
All right. Anyway, so these are three items about animals. Okay. And here
not
we
about
go.
Burgess Meredith.
They never
Burgess
knew Meredith. What his age was. He would never admit to his age, so he died. Nobody knew how old he really was.
Really?
Love that story about him. Yeah.
Hmm. All right. Here we go. Number one. A new study finds that mouse-eared bats use the polarization of light in the evening sky to calibrate their magnetic sense of direction. Item number two. Researchers find that worker honeybees keep their hives cool by using their bodies to absorb heat and then transfer the heat to cooler parts of the hive. And item number three, a 15-year study of blue whale feeding behavior finds that their feeding grounds have been moving steadily north. Rebecca, you haven't done one of these in a while, so why don't you go first?
Oh, man. Okay.
A double groan.
So using the polarization of light in the evening sky to calibrate their sense of direction. That's really cool. I can certainly see how that could work. Humans, we can't really, we can't see the polarization of light, but obviously we certainly can experience it when we wear polarized glasses. And I always thought that was really cool the way that worked. And so, yeah, I can believe that. Honeybees keep their hives cool using their bodies to absorb heat. And then transfer heat to cooler parts of the hive. That's weird. That's very complicated. And I can't imagine how that would actually work. So the hive heats up to greater than their body heat, their body temperature. They absorb that and then go to a cooler part. That, I don't know. Hives aren't, I guess they could take it down lower. I don't know. That's weird. Blue whale feeding behavior finds that their feeding grounds have been moving steadily north. So this is something that makes sense to me, and to the point where I'm kind of surprised to see this in the science or fiction, because I thought that this was like, this seems like a fact already, that something that would have already been established. So, which lends me to wonder if maybe it was already established and this is a fiction because maybe a new study came out disproving this, but it was my understanding that, thanks to global warming, whales were finding food further and further north. And so because of that, you know, obviously they're slowly migrating up that way. And there have been, maybe it's not blue whales, but I do know that climate change has had a very real impact on whales, migratory patterns and things, I thought. So I guess it's between the honeybees and the whales for me. One, because it sounds too ridiculous, and the other because it sounds too obvious. I guess I'll go with the honeybees one because I don't really see how that seems too complicated, for the bees to be doing. I'll go with that one.
Okay, Bob.
See, the mouse-eared bats using polarized light. It's funny how Rebecca just kind of blithely accepted that. That's actually fairly extraordinary for a mammal to use polarized light. I think they would be the only ones that I'm aware of. I'm not surprised, though, that that they could do that. That's really cool, and I really hope that that one is true. The blue whale feeding behavior, yeah, I could, that just makes perfect sense, which kind of scares me. But I'm having a big problem with the honeybee one. I just don't think bees have the heat capacity to make much of a difference. And even if they did, I think that their bodies are so tiny. I think they would transfer the heat, before they took 10 paces. Also, and don't they use their wings to like cool their hive? I remember seeing something about that a long time ago. I'm gonna say the bees is fiction as well.
Okay, Evan.
I guess I'll jump right to it. The bees, that was the thing that stood out for me, was the transfer of heat to cooler parts of the hive. I don't buy that part. The bees could be absorbing the heat. The only thing I could think of is that it's not deliberate. It just happens to be that way. But I don't know. I think the bees are too, purposeful in all that they do, for something like that to be the case. Yeah. And the blue whales real quick. Moving steadily north. I thought about the global warming as well, Rebecca. So there's nothing special there, I don't think. Polarization of lights. I didn't know about that one being the mammals special, especially the only mammal turned out to be, that uses this. It's very cool. And, a lot of things Rebecca said about that, I kind of agree with as well. So bees, fiction.
And Jay.
Yeah, I think the one about the bats and the polarization, that seems true. Now, let's go into the bees one. I've been really just thinking about this the last 5 minutes here. I mean, if you're saying that their bodies absorb the heat, I don't know about that. I mean, I would think that in order for them to absorb the heat, that they would need, maybe their fur captures heat somehow, but like, isn't it? I think they would be able to absorb more heat if they, had a lot more fluid in them. I just don't see insects as having a lot of fluid in them. Like, and I don't know. I just don't know how that they would be able to capture enough heat and then transfer it. I'll join the group and I'll say that the honeybees one is the fake.
So I guess I can take these in order. We'll start with number one. A new study finds that mouse-eared bats use the polarization of light in the evening sky to calibrate their magnetic sense of direction. You guys all think this one is science. And this one is... Have any of you heard of, by the way, Heidegger's brush?
What is it?
Heidegger's brush?
No.
Hadrian's Wall?
Nope, not Hadrian's Wall.
Oh.
Discovered by Austrian physicist Wilhelm Karl von Heidegger in 1844. I'll tell you about that in a second. This one is science.
Yeah, Hooray. Baby, that's cool. Ooh.
Yeah, these bats. So bats, we've known already that they use the magnetic field of the Earth to navigate at night. Mm-hmm. But in the early evening, like just after the sun sets, but there's still light in the sky, they check it out. They use the polarization of the light in order to calibrate their magnetic sense. And that holds them for that evening. So the way this was tested was the scientists had two groups of bats, a control group and an experimental group, and they exposed them to artificial polarization. One rotated 90 degrees from the actual polarization. And then in the middle of the night when there was no light, they brought them out like 20 miles away and released them. Now they should fly home. They should use their sense of navigation to fly back to the bat cave. The control group flew straight back to their cave. The experimental group flew off 90 degrees tangent from the direction of their cave.
Coincidence.
So, no.
Yeah, so pretty cool. They seem to.
Well, what happened to the bats?
They all died.
No,
I don't know.
Ran into a wind turbine.
They were lost for a day, and then the next day they found their way back. I don't know. But Heidegger's brush, some people can actually see polarized light.
People,
yes, human beings, yes.
Now, this can be measured, Steve, like it is in the brain scans and stuff?
I don't know about that. It's a very subtle, like bow tie shaped yellow light that it takes up about 3 to 5 degrees of vision that you can see against a blue sky when you have your back to the sun.
When you have your back to, okay.
Yeah, but not everybody can see it.
We must have some listeners who have this. Please write us.
Well, I want to go try this now. So what do? You're back to the sun and look at a blue sky?
Yes. Yeah. And you see a very tiny and very faint little bow tie of yellow light.
I am super excited to try this.
That is, if you see that you're seeing polarized light.
Very cool. Okay.
Jesus.
I got to try
it. I'm going to feel like a superhero if I can do that.
Check
what
it out.
Useless superpower, but I don't care.
All right, let's go on to number two. Researchers find that worker honeybees keeping their hives cool by using their bodies to absorb heat and then transfer the heat to cooler parts of the hive. You guys all think this one is the fiction. You don't think that honeybees are that cool. And this one.
Well, let's not turn this into an insult.
And this one is science.
Wow. I feel so damn wrong.
Yeah,
how do they do it, Steve?
Don't GWR, because I got teased relentlessly, by the way, in Minneapolis. People kept coming up to me and being like, do you know your science or fiction stats this year are in the toilet? Like, yeah, I know. And guess what? They still are.
All right. So, yeah, this is pretty cool. So they do use multiple methods to cool their hive, but what scientists discovered is that they actually, the worker bees, so their job is to keep, especially the brood, you know, the brood nest needs to be cool because adult bees can actually tolerate, up to 50 degrees Celsius, 122 Fahrenheit, but the brood can only tolerate up to 35 degrees Celsius or 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So what the scientists did was they maliciously heated up the nest.
Oh my God, scientists are the worst.
And then to see what the bees would do. And what the worker bees would push their bodies up against the brood nest wall, absorb the heat, and then fly to a cooler part of the nest and let the heat dissipate. And then keep shuttling the heat away from the brood nest.
But how are they doing it, Steve? I mean, aren't they spreading some type of liquid or something? Like, can't just be their bodies.
No, their bodies. Their bodies were transferring the heat. They would absorb the heat into their body. They would fly away and let it dissipate elsewhere.
They let it dissipate. So there must have been dissipation on the way to flying whirl.
Oh, sure. A little bit. Yeah, of course.
Curses.
It still was a net transfer of heat away from the brood nest. And it successfully reduced the temperature of the brood. Is that cool?
Got us, bastard.
Crap, not cool.
God damn it.
Which means that a 15-year study of blue whale feeding behavior finds that their feeding grounds have been moving steadily north is the fiction, because a 15-year study of blue whale feeding grounds, published recently in PLOS One, found that their feeding grounds are remarkably stable. They have, in fact, not moved
even
during El Nino and La Nina years. So even when the environmental conditions have been significantly different, the blue whales, individual blue whales, will stick to their feeding pattern. There are differences among individuals, but the individuals themselves are returning to their same feeding location patterns year after year, even again across different weather patterns. The authors state that they're hoping that this information will be useful for shipping lanes, because the big problem here is that the blue whale migrations cross over shipping lanes, and a lot of blue whales are getting killed by being hit by ships.
Oh,
and so, if they could make some adjustments, we may be able to steer clear of the blue whales, because obviously, you know, they're an endangered species. And I was able to say moving steadily north because blue whales are entirely a northern species, except maybe for pygmy bluebells, but they're mostly in North Atlantic, North Pacific, you know, Arctic type of creatures. Yeah.
How did scientists torment the blue whales? I mean, you know.
They tagged them.
They slowly moved their food away to see if they followed.
See, yes. Separate their calves from their mothers and see what happens.
Right. No, they just tagged them. I'm sure the whales didn't notice the tags.
Well.
Good job, Steve.
Well, nature got the better of us this week.
Good job.
Screw you, Steve.
Thank you. See, I found the bee one. I'm like, you know what? The thing is, if I just use one animal one, you guys would go, oh, animals are cool. I totally believe that. So I had to use three animal ones to neutralize the animal factor.
Neutralize.
Very, very smart, Steve.
Thank you.
Blue whales eat krill, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, make them kriller whales.
Kriller whales. Blue whales are my favorite animal. I did, you know, like when you're in third grade or whatever, you do reports on your animals and stuff. I always did the blue whale.
Mine was spiders.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
I have a quote.
Let's hear it.
Faced with the choice between changing one's mind and proving that there is no need to do so, almost everyone gets busy on the proof. This quote was sent in by a listener named Phil Sanders. And that quote is from a man named John Kenneth Galbraith. And he was a Canadian-American economist and author. Let me try to pronounce that again. John Kenneth Galbraith!
I have a quick plug. I'm not in this. No friends are in this. But I happened to go to a press event the other day for this new show called Androids that's going to be on Amazon Prime. Well, it's as of this episode going up, it's currently on streaming on Amazon Prime. And it's about a little girl scientist who builds her own robots in her dad's junkyard. And I met the cast and the creator, and they were all just such lovely people whose hearts are totally in the right place about encouraging science education, especially amongst little girls and people of color and people who are poor and, you know, come from a variety of backgrounds, single parent households. Like, everybody is represented in the show, and I saw the pilot. It was awesome, and I just really want the show to succeed. So it's called Androids. It's on Amazon Prime. Check it out.
Cool. And we're going to be at Atlanta at Dragon Con in September. Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's right.
And then in Sydney, Australia in November, and in New Zealand in December. And we're just really busy bees ourselves. And there are some other events coming up. Once we nail down the dates, we'll announce them. But we have some other things in the works. So stay tuned for some other events coming up. All right, guys. It's good to have the crew back together.
Yes.
Thank you, Steve. Comfortable.
It's too bad that you're a GMO shell and in bed with people who kill millions of children.
I'm a Nazi sympathizer.
Terrible.
And a baby eater.
And a lackey.
Say about us. Look and a lackey. Hang around with.
And you smell funny. Yeah. All right. Well, have a good night, Steve.
You guys all have a good night as well.
Thanks. Good night. Doc.
Bye-bye. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.